Hello, you're listening to Monocle Reads and I'm Georgina Godwin. My guest in the studio today is Samra Habib, who is a writer, a feminist and a voice for queer Muslims. In her new book, a memoir entitled We Have Always Been Here, she explores identity, faith, love and art, from her childhood in Pakistan to escaping religious persecution and emigrating to Canada. Samra, thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
I want to start with your early life in Pakistan because, in fact, you were members of a small dynamic sect. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so my family is part of this small sect we're called Ahmadiyyas. It was founded in 1889. And a lot of the members from the sect face religious persecution. And, you know, as a child, I sort of was very aware of this sort of fear around me. And, you know, there were certain things that we couldn't do. You know, my parents would have these sort of sessions where they would rehearse like our conversations with other kids in the school to ensure that we won't reveal our religious identity. Because, you know, if it was revealed, we would be persecuted, our lives could be in danger. And that was the reason that we left Pakistan, because, you know, my parents felt like we deserved a safer life.
And what does the sect believe then?
It's very much about, you know, sort of like renewing a lot of the religious beliefs that are already existing. So, you know, a lot of religious beliefs that were laid out by the Prophet Muhammad. So it's not a new religion. And I mean, I don't call myself Ahmadi anymore. It's not really a sect that I connect to. But it's nothing different. It's nothing new. Yeah, it's just sort of renewing the Islamic beliefs that have existed forever.
Do you call yourself religious?
I call myself spiritual. And, you know, the older I get, the identity of being a Muslim and a queer person is something that resonates with me more and more, because I find that it's almost sort of become this sort of, you know, like a political thing to say, or, you know, it's sort of, because I feel like, you know, it's a, As a queer person, like, it's an identity that I am often made to feel is not something that I have any right to. So for me to sort of declare that that is identity that I have a right to hold on to, it's just something that means a lot to me. And I know the kind of impact it has when I sort of embrace both of those identities.
I want to very much pick apart this idea of identity, which, of course, is at the core of the book. But first of all, tell me about leaving Pakistan, because that was all quite traumatic, and going off to Canada, seeking asylum, really.
Yeah. So I was around 10 years old and, you know, we were pretty much told in the middle of the night that right now was the time for us to leave. So my mom, you know, grabbed us, and my dad couldn't come right away because he had some business to tend to. And we just, you know, almost overnight, we were like uprooted. We just sort of, we left Pakistan and we moved to Canada to sort of like start, you know, what we thought was a better life. And yeah, we didn't really know anyone in Canada. And it was, for me, it was kind of a really turning point, because I felt like here I was, a child in Pakistan. And almost overnight, as a result of moving to a different country and having like a better understanding of the English language than my mom, I became a parent overnight. And I wasn't really sort of given a warning, you know, having to sort of communicate to my mom, but the officials, the authorities were saying, taking her to a doctor's appointment. So I just sort of feel like, you know, what maybe oftentimes people don't talk about is the loss of a childhood that happens for a lot of refugees.
Yes, yes. And navigating your way in this strange and new environment, a racist environment at all?
Yeah, you know, racist. And I feel like, you know, so many things are sort of built into our environment, and obviously things are changing, but where you don't really realize that things are not really set up to benefit people who are not white. You know, whether it's like in school, you know, sort of being made to feel that I was strange for, you know, having an accent and sort of not having culturally appropriate supports that could have helped me integrate to the society better. I think it's like, as I get older, you know, I'm almost 40 now. Now is really the time when I'm having to sort of unpack the impact that kind of upbringing in Canada had had on me, and in ways in which I still continue to silence myself or sort of like, you know, change myself so that other people's are more comfortable. I think it's really now that I'm sort of having more courage to sort of like talk about ways in which I'm different mm-hmm. and my experiences are different.
Now, of course, being queer in this day and age is not seen as particularly different or shocking, but I'm sure that when you were growing up in Canada, it was. How did you come to terms with your own sexuality?
You know, the people often, for example, ask me, like, when did you come out? And I think a lot of queer people come out over and over again. And, you know, first time I came out, it was to myself. And then I came out to my siblings. And then I came out to my mother eventually, and then my father. And I think for me, the real struggle for me was sort of trying to find out whether or not there was place in Islam for me as a queer person. And, you know, that kind of question, that big question that I had, led me to launch my photo project. It's called Just Me and Allah, and I worked on it for 5 years. And, you know, it really started with this question of, is there a place for queer people within Islam? And that led me to travel around the world, photograph, you know, a lot of young queer Muslims, actually, and interview them about their relationship with Islam. And I think, you know, while I was doing that, I was actually trying to figure out whether or not there was place for me and how other people sort of navigated their relationship with Islam while being queer. So for me, it was more kind of like an exploration. I took this challenge as like an incentive for me to explore and learn more about where I stood.
And was there an overriding theme that came back from the people that you spoke to around the world?
Yeah, you know, what I learn, and it's sort of like, I think it gets validated all the time, is this belief, this idea that a lot of the people's relationship with Islam, unfortunately, is guided by other people's perception of it. So what I found was oftentimes people tend to sort of fight back and kind of have to sort of face this kind of, you know, the challenges imposed on them by other people who feel like, how dare they? Mm. You know, they have no right to call themselves Muslim because of their queer identity. So, you know, a lot of them are just struggling just to, like, live and just, you know, just live as queer people.
Now, I know that obviously there are many different branches of Islam, but is there an official take on whether homosexuality of any type is allowed within the religion?
I mean, I'm not really able to find like a conclusive answer, you know, and that is why I go to this queer mosque in Toronto.
There is a queer mosque?
There is a queer, and actually, you know what? There's a queer mosque in London too. It's called Inclusive Mosque. So that queer mosque that launched in Toronto, Canada is kind of a blueprint for these queer affirming mosques that are popping up everywhere, including here. I actually met with the female imam yesterday. She came by to my talk at the Tate. So they're popping up everywhere. So I think, you know, to me, that is what the future of Islam could look like, right? As a result of sort of like these challenges faced by so many young people. And what's so nice about these queer mosque spaces is that not all people there are queer. There are a lot of just young people or a lot of people who are just sort of, you know, who also just believe in having an inclusive mosque and believe that everyone should have the right to pray, which is really nice.
And in terms of having a female imam, I mean, that takes us down the whole route of feminism and Islam. Is that something that sits easily side by side?
I think so. And I mean, you know, that is very much connected to how a lot of young people I know are reimagining Islam and what Islam could be, you know, like, for example, this female imam I met, you know, like, I'm sure, you know, she was told in her entire life that that is not really a role that is up for grabs for a woman, but she, you know, is very much part of this movement that is kind of like challenging that notion. Mm. So I think so. And I mean, you know, Prophet's wife, Khadija, who I always sort of saw as kind of like a feminist figure. So I feel like if you were to look, there are feminist role models within Islam who we don't really talk about. And, you know, I'm not like an expert on like Muslim history. So I feel like I am not really like in the place to really sort of talk about those examples. But I saw really strong female figures around me. So the fact, you know, my mom, for example, is one of them. And she probably doesn't know what feminism is. And, you know, she hasn't read the same feminist authors I have, but I see herself as a feminist figure.
How much tension exists between the old ways of doing things and this more progressive form of Islam?
There's a lot of tension, for sure. And I mean, I am faced with it myself in that, you know, the Ahmadiyya mosque that I went to as a kid, you know, I know that a lot of officials at the mosque, at least in Toronto, are uncomfortable with me saying that, you know, I'm a queer person who grew up Ahmadi. So there's a lot of tension, and I don't really know what I can do about it other than just live my life.
I know that in the book you write about how the men in your life wanted to police you. A lot of the women in your life had only shown you the example of blind obedience. And I wonder how you get away from that.
You know, I learned at a very young age, around the time when I found out that my mom arranged to marry me when I was a child, that, you know, my parents could not protect me. They were not my protectors. They were not really situated in a way where they could provide me safety in the ways that I needed. So, you know, I feel like very early on, as a result of that, I felt like I had to look out myself, and being obedient would not provide me safety, the kind of safety that I was seeking. So I feel like, you know, going through that and, you know, leaving my marriage when I was 16 years old and then eventually running away from home, like those were all steps that I took at a very early age. And so I no longer feel that this role of like obedient Muslim housewife is like something that I need to subject myself to, because I feel like I've already done that. I've already like sort of escaped that when I was 16, when I was 18. So it's not even an expectation that my parents have on me anymore. They just kind of, yeah, they just accept me for who I am.
Tremendous courage, though.
Thanks. But, you know, I feel like I see my mother as a very sort of a subversive figure in that, you know, even though she sort of lived this kind of life, or she became a sacrificial lamb, as I describe her in the book, she sort of gave us, the girls, these glimpses of, you know, what she also wanted from us or what she hoped from us, whether it was higher education or having independence. Like, she sort of like added these snippets into our conversations about how that is also a dream of hers. So I think, you know, she really did. I really, really believe that she planted the seeds of the kind of independence and autonomy that my sisters and I exercise today.
I wonder how you feel about the veil and women and feminism and wearing the veil, because the two are not necessarily completely removed from each other. You can be a feminist and choose to be covered.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I feel like it's really up to individual women, right? If it is something that you choose to do and how you choose to sort of, you know, announce to the world your allegiance to the religion of Islam, then I think that is your choice, right? In my specific experience, and obviously I can only speak to my experience and what I saw in my mother, you know, it felt like it was forced upon us. It was definitely forced upon me. So, you know, it is a choice that I made to not wear the hijab as I was sort of, you know, discovering that I wanted to make my own decisions, and I happen to really love my hair.
It's very beautiful hair.
Thank you.
The whole process of writing the book, was that cathartic for you?
For sure. You know, I was actually talking to someone about this yesterday. Now, reading the book now after having written it, I almost feel a bit detached from the person I've talked about in the book, because I feel like I've moved on after having written about it. You know, there is a really great James Baldwin quote where he says, you know, not everything that is faced can be changed, but nothing can be changed until it is faced. And I feel like writing the book gave me the opportunity to sort of face the trauma that I had been carrying all my life. So I faced it, I dealt with it, and I am ready to move on.
And I feel like Islam is ready to move on, and that certainly what you represent is the face of a new religion, a religion that is not as divisive as some Westerners believe it to be.
Yeah, I think so. And I think, you know, part of that also has to do with the fact that I think who is selected to sort of represent Islam is changing in media as well. And, you know, I think we are seeing sort of a diverse range of voices when it comes to people who represent Islam. So I think that probably has a lot to do with it, too.
Where do you see the future?
You know, the way I see it, and judging from like the conversations that I've been having, I think it might be hard to believe it at this point in history, but I see future as being more empathetic. You know, I feel like there's a hunger for other people's stories who are not like us, and sort of look for connective tissues that sort of lead us to this realization that we're not as different as we think we are. You know, one of the really great realizations that I've been having while doing this book tour is that, you know, while I was writing, I had these four post-it notes in front of me, and they were really specific people who I thought I was writing the book for. And they were, you know, like queer Muslim kids and people who look like me. But what's really interesting is to see the kind of people who come up to me to tell me that the book really resonated with them, and they saw sort of like a lot of sort of commonalities. And oftentimes they're, you know, older white women who've been married their entire lives. And that just makes me feel that, you know, people are sort of finding that the experiences of like pain and hope and joy, they're actually universal.
Absolutely. Samra, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We Have Always Been Here by Samra Habib is published by River Run, and it's out now. You've been listening to Monocle Reads, thanks to the production team of Nora Hull, Steph Chungu and Charlie German. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.